31. Next time, man, I gotta look up faster. Good to see you all. Good morning. Welcome back to our class in Acts. Is there a picture behind me of an Acts review? Not yet. It's coming, though. Charles promised me it's coming. He's got good help back there. Hey, Jared. What's up, man? Jared the Tech. That's what I'm going to start calling you. There it is. What have we covered in Acts so far? Well, we have seen the establishment of the church in chapter 2. And we go there a lot in sermons and Bible studies, but that's where it happens, Acts chapter 2. It all comes together. And then we saw the gospel preached to the Sanhedrin in chapter 4. Do you remember what was the catalyst? What got that started? How come Peter and John had an opportunity to preach to the Sanhedrin? They went up to the temple, and there was a lame man there, and they healed him, and it caused a great stir among the people. And they were coming together to hear them preach in the temple, and the Sanhedrin didn't like it, so they pulled them in and said, don't do that anymore. And they said, okay, we won't preach Jesus anymore. No, they didn't say that, did they? They kept right on preaching. So that's their opportunity to preach to the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin hears the gospel. In chapter 8, we see the church persecuted in Jerusalem, and everybody leaves, but who didn't leave? You remember? The church was scattered abroad except for the apostles. They stayed in Jerusalem, at least for a while. And then we see Saul's conversion in chapter 9 on his way to Damascus to persecute the church. And Jesus appears to him and he's converted. Then chapter 10, we see the conversion of Cornelius, the first Gentile. And then in chapters 11 and 15, there are conventions, meetings, discussions about the Gentiles coming into the kingdom. And then James is killed, first apostle to die in chapter 12. And then we get down to where we are today, the first missionary journey from Antioch to Antioch. Antioch in Syria sends out Barnabas and Paul, and they wind up in Antioch of Pisidia. And so that's where we are. And Charles, you can shut that down now if you want. We are finished with the review. Anybody got anything over the review? Anything you want to go back to, look at again, talk about again? Any points you want to make? All right, chapter 13. In chapter 1 of chapter 13, we see him leaving or being sent out from Antioch in Syria. And they wind up in Antioch of Pisidia down in verse 14. And when they get there, in verse 15... they're in the synagogue, and what do those leaders of the synagogue say to Paul and Barnabas? And you can read it. It's okay. That's not cheating. If you've got any words of exhortation, say on. What an opportunity. And so they begin to preach. And one of the things I wanted to point out, we kind of didn't skip over it, but we didn't deal with it in great detail. If you look down at verse 26, somebody read for us 26 through 29. Who'd like to read that for us? Chapter 13, 26 to 29. Anybody? I know it's Sunday morning. Everybody's tired. Larry?
Brethren, sons of Abraham's family, and those among you who fear God, to us the message of this salvation has been sent. For those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled these by condemning him. And though they found no ground for putting him to death, they asked Pilate that he be executed. When they had carried out all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb.
All right, I want you to make some observations with me about this text, about Paul's statement. Brethren, sons of Abraham's family, talking to Jewish people who've got the law and the prophets, the message of this salvation has been preached for those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him, Jesus, nor the utterances of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath. So here's an observation he makes. You should have recognized Jesus as the Messiah And you should have at least recognized the matchup with the utterances of the prophets. Everything the prophets said about Jesus had come to pass in him. And then he says this: when they carried out all that was written concerning him. When who carried out? That would be the Jewish people. When they carried, they fulfilled the prophecies. They knew the prophecies, should have known all the prophecies, and yet they are the very ones who carried out everything that was prophesied about Jesus. It wasn't Jesus, per se, who fulfilled all those prophecies. What Paul is pointing out is, you fulfilled them. You should have known them, and you fulfilled them, and you didn't recognize him as the Messiah. I just think that's an interesting observation that he makes, and that still remains to this very day an excellent way to show people the reliability of the Bible, that those texts of Scripture, these ancient prophetic texts about Jesus, are verified to be that old, especially with the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they foretold what would happen with Jesus, which record is 10 times more better verified than any other historical document. And that's a very conservative statement. All right, so that's chapter 13. And as they're in, by the way, where are they now in chapter 13? What city? Antioch, but which Antioch? Pisidian. Antioch in Syria sent them out, and now they're in Pisidian Antioch. And it says in verse 42, chapter 13, verse 42, as Paul and Barnabas were going out, the people kept begging that these things might be spoken to them the next Sabbath. Isn't that an exciting statement to look back in history and see people were begging to hear more about the gospel? But then what happens in verse 44? Everybody came around, crowds gathered to hear the gospel preached, and what happened then? The Jews saw it and they got jealous, and they caused a stir. This is the beginning of persecution against the church by the Jews. It's not the beginning, but this is where it starts to happen abroad. It happened in Jerusalem, and Paul was one of those persecuting the church. But now he is abroad. He's in Antioch of Pisidia, and more persecution is getting started here, and this persecution is going to follow him. They'll go from town to town. Everywhere Paul goes, they'll follow him, raise a fuss. Were they retired? What was the deal? Didn't have jobs they had to go to. They take time off. Let's take some vacation time and go persecute Paul. Hey, that's a great idea. I think I've got some days coming. What's going on here? Anyway, that's what you see throughout the rest of Acts. Seems like the world's always got time to do evil. Okay. In verse 48 of 13, when Paul and Barnabas shake the dust off their feet with regard to the Jews and went to the Gentiles began rejoicing and glorifying the word of the Lord, as many had been, and as many as had been appointed to eternal life believed. And the word of the Lord was being spread through the whole region. And then there's more incitement by the Jews in verse 50. So 51 actually tells us that they shook the dust off their feet. And that's when they headed for Iconium. And that's what we're picking up to read about in chapter 14. So I need three readers. Chapter 14, 1 to 7. Who's got that? Anybody for 1 to 7? Okay, Janie. And then 8 to 13. Who will read 8 to 13 in chapter? All right, Jamie. And then 14 to 18. All right, Rich, we're good to go. Let's read the first part of chapter 14. Yes? Paul was Jewish, and he was also a Roman citizen, so he had some clout. I have no idea. It doesn't say anything about what had reached, but it may have been that they had heard of his reputation as a Pharisee or as even a persecutor. It doesn't say. But at first, as they were hearing this, everything was going great. And then they got jealous. It was probably customary if you had a visitor and you knew, okay, he's a Jewish guy, see if he's got anything to say. There's just not much commentary on this. So things were a little different then. I don't know that their services were as ordered as ours were. This was a different culture as well. They wouldn't have had to have a schedule to come in to get a, okay, here's what's going to do this and do that. At any rate, they there's nothing in the text that tells us. It just says that they did. So there must have been something about them that somebody said, hey, you know what? Let's see if these guys got anything to say. Maybe it was one of those mornings where not too many guys showed up who wanted to talk. Hey, maybe these guys will say something. So, good question, though. All right. Who was first? Janie.
Now at Iconium, they entered together into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Gentiles believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So they remained for a long time, speaking boldly for the Lord, and bore witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. When an attempt was made by both Jews and Gentiles with their rulers to mistreat them and to stone them, they learned of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Iconia, and to the surrounding country. And there they continued to preach the gospel.
And in Lystra, a certain man, without strength in his feet, was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet." And he leaped and walked. Now, when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." And Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gate, intending to sacrifice with the multitude.
But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you and preach the gospel to you in order that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. And yet he did not leave himself without witnesses, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. And even saying these things, they with difficulty restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them."
Isn't this interesting? Kind of a culture where you come into town and you do the works of God and you are called to God yourself. So where do they first go anyway when they come into Iconium? Synagogue, where they always go. They always went to the synagogue first. Paul had a Jewish background, and back to Kit's question or observation, they would ask them to speak, which they apparently did, because it says they spoke in such a manner there in verse 1 that a large number of people believed, both of Jews and Greeks. So he had to have been given quite a bit of opportunity, because what he said converted some people to Christ. But there we are again, verse 2, the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. When Solomon wrote Proverbs, God inspired him to tell about seven things that he hates. And the last one is those who sow discord among brethren. So I can't imagine how God would deal with these guys. His son has come. The obvious fulfillment of all those prophecies has taken place, and still they do not believe, and they're stirring up other people's minds not to believe. It's one thing if you want to say, well, I don't want to believe that, but you go ahead and do what you want. No, I'm going to convince you. It's kind of like in today's culture where it's not good enough for you to have your belief and me to have mine. I have to force my belief on you. That's what a lot of people are thinking these days. You have to think like we think. You can't just comply. You have to think like we think. And it's crazy. But it's not anything new. That's what was going on here. So it says in verse 3, they spent a long time there speaking out boldly. And what was God doing for them? Says he was, Michelle, you look like you're going to tell me. Yes. And Luke records this as God is testifying through these signs and wonders. God is giving his own evidence through them that what they are saying and what they are preaching is all legit. Verse 4, more division. The people of the city are divided. Some sided with the Jews, some with the apostles. But then an attempt was made by Gentiles and Jews to mistreat the apostles and stone them. Let's put these guys to death. So that's where they are at that point. And when Paul and Barnabas became aware of it, what did they do? Is that okay? Is it okay to leave where you're being persecuted? Or does that show a lack of faith or a lack of courage? Okay. What did Jesus say about casting your pearls? Or don't cast them before swine. Don't put what's holy before dogs. So they were simply following Jesus. And when he sent the 70 out in chapter 10 of Matthew's gospel, you can read about it there. He said, if they don't receive you, what are you supposed to do? Shake the dust off your feet. Don't stand there and argue with them. If they're not going to welcome you, shake the dust off your feet and you move on. That's what they were doing. They were following the teachings of Jesus in leaving. So where'd they go? Lycaonia and Lystra and Derbe. What kind of hats do you think people wore in Derbe? So they run into this guy in Lystra who's been lame. How long? His whole life from his mother's womb. And what does Paul do? What show does he put on? He doesn't. What does he do? He says, stand up. There's no great. Everybody gather around. I'm going to do a great thing here. I'm going to wave my hands over this guy. Do you remember Naaman the leper? He goes to the prophet for healing. And what does the prophet do? Does the prophet tell him that? No. Who tells him that? He doesn't even come out of the house. He sends his servant to go tell Naaman. And who's Naaman? He's the captain of the host of Syria. He's an extremely powerful guy. And he doesn't even come out to greet him. He says, oh, go tell him to go down in the River Jordan and dip seven times. So what's the question? Do you want to be do you want to be treated special, or do you want to get rid of your leprosy? That's the thing. That's the question. And so here's Paul. He doesn't make a big show of it. And there's nothing in the text, but I'm just surmising a couple of things. Number one, there has to be some compassion, I would think. Here's a man who's been lame all of his life. He's an adult man, but he's lame and he's been lame from his mother's womb. I don't know if Paul knows that or not, if he just sees the situation, and maybe there was something about his lameness that led Paul to understand this has been this way for a long time. We need to fix this. And so it just tells him, get up and walk. Another thing is, He already knows what the wonders and signs do. They're evidence to people that validate the message that they're preaching. And so there's something else. The text doesn't say either way. He just says what he does.
About the minds of these people, specifically the apostles, and being in the presence of Jesus for 3 years, and then having experienced all of everything, and then informed by the Spirit, and then they're being led by the Spirit. And so their perception is, I mean, directly guided by the Spirit and by God, what they know and they see. And so how they act and react is a really good example of how Jesus acted and reacted. And not always perfectly, because they did argue with amongst themselves. But it just makes you think about the religious. There was, I was trying to remember whenever one of the apostles was talking to someone, he said, "True hypocrisy, you are a religious person." Mm-hmm. They're in a city that's very religious. And here they are trying to maneuver through all of this different variations of who they think is the deity. And this is a really good snapshot of how they see and they think and how they're being guided by the Spirit.
Right. Yeah, that's coming in chapter 17 when it gets to Athens. And it's a similar situation to what's going on here. They've got Zeus and Hermes that they're going to call these guys. Billy, you had something on.
It shows that this guy is listening to Paul. And when he had fixed his gaze upon him, and had seen that he had faith. Paul seen that he had faith to be healed. And he says, stand up.
Right. So it's not just a random, disconnected circumstance. This guy's listening and Paul sees he's got faith to be healed. And then Luke doesn't go into that. What was it about this guy? Just a smile on his face, the sense of eagerness that Paul might have seen in him as he preached this message of hope? I don't know. But at any rate, and there's another question that arises. Did Paul just decide on his own, or did the Spirit prompt him? It doesn't say one way or the other. It just says he said that. Was he so in fellowship with the Spirit at this point and so working together that he just knew, I could say this and it'll happen? I don't know. But it's fascinating to me how it comes together.
He was so in tune with the Spirit and being guided by God and experiences. And, you know, the Spirit had told him that they will bring into remembrance all these things that I have told you. Plus, you know, I mean, they're being guided by God's Spirit. I mean, they have ready recollection of the Scriptures. I mean, it's just all the above that God's making his power very present to show them, this is me. This is I am. And here you are. You have the ability to make your own decision. And then, of course, I can't reason about it. It's very interesting. All the different facets. You go crazy trying to chase rabbit holes and see and try to imagine. But it comes down to the simple truth that Jesus died. You guys crucified him. Now the Gentiles have the chance to be children of God. And this is all brought together in a very religious setting in the city that sees them maybe as possibly Greek gods.
Right.
So it's very, very neat in a way, but fascinating, because we live in that same type of a scenario, not the same, but there's so many different types of beliefs, and it helps us to kind of see that we're unique. It's not ever been like this yet. It is, we just have to glean what they did and help try to apply it to our lives so that we can stay on the straight.
I'm sure you've done it like I have. You look at either the religious or the political climate in our country and you wonder, how can people believe the things that they believe? And I'm sure there are people looking at me going, how can you believe the things that you believe? I know they're doing that because I get that from them. But we all believe something. What had just happened to these guys at Antioch, at Pisidian Antioch? What were the people there wanting to do? They want to stone them, abuse them and stone them. And now they're in this town And because of what they see them do, they're ascribing divinity to them. Jamie?
And it makes sense that the Greeks would, because throughout their religious knowledge, they've been told the stories of God's coming down and performing things and having children and doing all of these things. So, wow, you know, I've heard about this for hundreds of years. Now I finally get to see one. Oh, so somebody finally came down to our town. So that wasn't an uncommon occurrence in their religion. So I could understand from their perspective why they would say these two guys were.
And it's said jokingly that God created man in his image, and we've been trying to return the favor ever since. In other words, we're trying to recreate God in our image, but that's what happened with the Greek and Roman gods. They assumed human qualities about their gods, and so they were afraid of them, not because they were authoritative like the true and living God is, but because they were human-like and capricious, and you might make him mad by doing something that wouldn't make the real God mad, but you'll make him mad. And so he might not cause your chickens to lay eggs, or your wife might become barren, or your crops might fail, or send a hailstorm just because you didn't pronounce his name right or something. That's the way their gods were. And so who is it that shows up to offer sacrifice to these guys, or because of these guys? It's the priest of their most high God. Why doesn't the priest of their most high God know better than to do this? Why does he equate these guys with his God? And there's really only one word that'll describe it, and that one word is ignorance. They really don't know the gods. They're groping after the gods. Preston mentioned Athens, that's what's happening up there. Paul goes into this place where they've got monuments to all the gods, but there's one that says to who? To the unknown God, because they don't know if they even know it. They don't want to leave one out and make him mad, so they have one to the unknown God. Paul says, that's the one I want to talk to you about. It's the only God that really is. You've got all these others you've made up. So, yeah, that's pretty common, as Jamie mentioned, for them to think like that, because they don't know, and they come up with stuff. Have you ever talked to somebody who is in one of these hoodoo, maybe that's not a nice way to say it, but that's how I observe, a religion that deals with sorcery or witchcraft or necromancy, talking to the dead? They really don't have any solid belief. There's no document that they can go to say, this is how you're supposed to believe and this is how you're supposed to act and behave. It's so wonderful, and I tell people this about being a preacher. One of the great things about being a preacher is your material never changes. You don't have to keep up to date. I would hate to be an auto mechanic today, because every new car that comes out's got some new thing on it that doesn't really have anything to do with mechanics. It's all about electronics. And you pop the hood, what do you see? Nothing that looks like an engine. It's all covered over with plastic. And you go, what in the world? How do I? Yeah, and then you think of somebody, oh, just take it down to AutoZone. They'll plug in that little thing under your dash, and it'll tell you what's wrong with your car. No, it'll tell you 46 possible things that are wrong with your car. And that I'm not blaming AutoZone, but you say, okay, now I've got to buy 46 different things to try to fix it and start plugging one. Did that fix it? No, that didn't do it. I got to plug. Oh, did that do it? No, didn't do that. So it's crazy. All the things that are in the world that people can believe and do believe, when there's really not that much basis for it at all. Christianity is so much better in every way, and it compels you to be better. There's nothing in the gospel that they're preaching that leads me to believe I can satisfy my own lust, I can go my own way, do my own thing, I'm okay, you're okay, and that's not going to help me at all. To look at me in my sin, in my weakness, in my sensuality, in my fleshliness, my carnality, and say, you're good, Don't worry about it. You're going to be you can't leave but talk. You're going to be all right. Because I won't if I stay in that. I've got to have something higher. I've got to have something better. I've got to have something more noble. I've got to have something to pull me along and lead me along, just like Jesus, as the good shepherd, would do for his sheep. The 23rd Psalm, what does Jesus do? What does the shepherd do? He leads me in such a way that I don't have anything that I stand in need of. I shall not want. Makes me lie down in green pastures. He restores my soul. Leads me beside the still waters, because the sheep won't drink from running water. He's got to have still, calm water. All those things that the shepherd says about the sheep, that's what the gospel does for us. That's what God is doing for us right now. In all these other religions, these guys, the priest comes and he doesn't even know that these guys are not the gods that he worshiped. They are servants of the Most High God. And that's the ignorance of the world. And by the way, after a little convincing, what do these people want to do? And I know we're getting ahead of ourselves. We haven't read that part yet. You're allowed to read ahead, by the way. Did I tell you that in the beginning of this class? You get down to verse 19. But Jews came from Antioch. What Antioch? Not Syrian Antioch. Syrian Antioch sent them on this mission, but they were opposed in Pisidian Antioch, and now Jews are coming from Pisidian Antioch in verse 19. And they won over the crowds, and what happened? So Paul comes into town. He heals a man who's been lame from birth. They ascribe divinity to them, and they're about to sacrifice to him, and now, oh, let's stone him instead. This is the world. When you see confusion in the world, don't be surprised. No need to get upset. It's been this way forever. It's always going to be this way. Jesus said, in the world, you'll have trouble. But be of good cheer. Why? I have overcome the world, and we will overcome the world through him. Just stay with Jesus. Stay with the shepherd. That's what Paul is doing. Even when he is stoned in verse 19, what's he do? Get the picture in verse 20. It's almost comical. He's stoned, being dragged out of the city. I know it does. It doesn't. You know those apostles. Yeah. That's all right. He was hit by rocks. That's the kind of stoning he had. Drugged. Now you got me doing it. Dragged out of the city, and they supposed him to be dead. Verse 20, while the disciples stood around him. Get that picture. He's laying on the ground having been stoned. They think he's dead. They're just standing around him, and what does he do? He gets up and he goes back. Who else did that? Jesus did that. He's heading to Jerusalem after they tried to kill him in Jerusalem. And the apostles are saying, Master, don't you know? And who's the one apostle who says, well, if he's going, I'm going too. Let's just go die with him. Who said that? It was Thomas. Thomas. See, Thomas got a bad rap in the garden, or not in the garden, but after the resurrection, because he says, well, I won't believe until I see him, which was the case with every other apostle. Duh. But Thomas got the bad rep of being doubting Thomas when he's the one who said, well, if he's going to Jerusalem and he's going to die, let's go with him. I'll die too. That was what Thomas did. So now Paul is going back into town to preach again. Verse 21, after they had preached the gospel in that city and had made many disciples. Think about that. They threw rocks at him until they thought he was dead, having drug him out of town, and he goes back into town and he preaches and still makes a bunch of disciples. Then they return to Lystra and Iconium and Antioch. And this is what they do in verse 22. They strengthened the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, saying, what did they say? Through many tribulations. I read this as an American Christian, And I wonder, here we stand, well, I stand, you sit, in the heat of Oklahoma July in an air-conditioned building in padded pews, lights, we just had a, what's that thing called, a PowerPoint, I've got a speaker system, I don't have to scream and yell so you can hear me. I'm sorry if it sounds like I do sometimes. We've got the printed page. Any translation of the Bible you want to have, you can. If that's not enough, you can get on your phone and look up the internet. Well, man, we got it good. It's not wrong to have it good. It's not bad to have it good. But Paul is saying through many tribulations, and he got that from the Lord, through many tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. And I'm not saying none of us have trouble, but it does me good to think about my brothers and sisters in other parts of the world who don't have it as good as I do, and pray for them. Think about them wherever they may be. And you can read about them anytime you want. Just Google it. Persecution of Christianity. You'll find an abundance of it throughout the world. And we, I can't imagine any place else in the world that has it as good as we do right here in central Oklahoma. How many congregations of the church are there in this area? A bunch of them.
Okay. It takes some comfort, though, as well, because, you know, things were getting more and more volatile. I mean, God knew that the destruction of Jerusalem was going to come. I mean, it feels so much, and I know it was different, but at the same time, history always repeats itself, mankind is the same. So I apply it to myself as a Christian, very aware of the volatile times, very aware of just the deep stench of sin that we're all just, you know, it's around us all the time, we're having to trudge through it, and then we all just, even today, feel the sense that in our culture, something's building, and it's not positive. And a lot of the things as we know it will possibly not be that way before too long. So there's just this this discouragement that is here today, was there then, because they could see it, the Romans around them and even the Jews. And so I take a lot of comfort that Paul was comforting them and saying, okay, you know, we must, through tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. So the two can coexist, and the one is greater, and you can take comfort in it. So I just really think that's just like today.
It's an excellent point.
I mean, as far as Christians in our state and how we need to think about.
And we have no clue what tomorrow will bring. On one hand, could you have seen the overturning of Roe versus Wade?
Yes.
All right?
I saw it.
You saw it coming?
Yeah, I could tell it was coming.
You're a prophet, man.
No, I mean, you can tell. You can just tell. I mean, conservative judiciary and Roe versus Wade was not properly decided in the first place. The basis for it was not correct. So it was bound to be overturned.
And that's what happens when you put conservative judges who are willing to go by the law and the Constitution in the Supreme Court. Sure.
The end of the world, we don't know. But the end of the United States as we know it, yes, it's going to happen. But does that mean the end of Christianity? You know, when I look back in the Bible, same Bible we all read, God did not destroy the world until he created the flood, but there just wasn't anybody left. We've still got lots of Christians.
Absolutely. It wasn't that long ago that there was a big hoopla over the president of Chick-fil-A who said, and all he said was, we support traditional family. And what happened? There were whole people, I'm not eating Chick-fil-A anymore. Well, what happened? People lined up to eat chicken. And they didn't even like it. Some of them, I read some of their statements. I don't care about the chicken sandwich. I'll probably give it away once. But I'm going to eat chicken just to make a point. You can say what you want in this country, and you ought to have freedom. I'm telling you, people were lying. Do you remember that? Yeah. I preached a sermon about that. And I was right proud of it, too. Because just all that positivity there, and then this, and it's in the midst of, as Carrie is saying, a culture and a time where I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and people are even talking, how many times have you heard the idea of civil war? Now there's a little part of me, I probably shouldn't tell you this, little bitty part of me that just hopes we do have one, because who's got the guns and knows how to use them? No, that's not right. I don't want that to happen. I said that kind of as a joke, but there's the reality, too, that some folks are just so crazy, they'll push and push and push. I heard somebody say the overturning of Roe versus Wade wasn't the fault of even the conservative judges or Christians. It was the fault of those who kept pushing for more and more leniency until you could kill a child right up until the moment of its birth, coming out of its mom, and said that's what drove people nuts. No, you're just crazy and you're pushing it too far. I don't know how many guys who have been on the left are now saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? They won't even listen to me now. It just gets crazy. Don?
Just to reference what Norman and Gary said, and you said too, we don't know what God has in store, what the plan is. On one hand, we're hoping for the best. But on the other hand, Terry said we need to be ready for the worst. I mean, we've seen both. We've seen the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which is good. We've also seen Satan scatter the church, too, here recently, trying to use a disease to say, oh, hey, let's not gather anymore. And so and people are hurting still from that. Churches are still hurting from that. People are scattered because of that. People aren't coming back because of that. And there may come a time where that's just a couple of months. It could get scattered a lot worse. It could be like this.
Sure.
And is our faith strong enough to keep that relationship with God, or our heart's going to grow cold, and we're going to, I don't want to misconstrue what you just said, we're going to get our guns out and start fighting everybody. And,
no.
Now, in reference to that, I just feel like to make a point about that. We shouldn't really get guns on our own and try to fight. If we have a government to fight with, for example, just there's a million scenarios, but Oklahoma decides to fight against the federal government. We can take up arms with Oklahoma. We can't just take up arms in a ragtag thing and start fighting everybody.
Right.
Now, we might be able to protect our own home, but, I want to throw that in there because we have guns in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
And how should we use them as Christians? We've got to be sure and do that biblically.
And the church.
We've got to have a government that we're attached to that will be in store if we do take up arms.
Right. The church has never been called by God to take up arms. Never. And never will. Gary?
Opinions.
I'm sorry?
About, Christians will have differing thoughts and opinions amongst each other even about the culture. I really think the point here is being strengthened in your soul, being steadfast in our faith, and just knowing that the tribulations, are a part of it. I'm curious to see, through many tribulations we must enter. I mean, that seems like present tense, right now. Christians, wherever they're at in time, right at that moment, there will be tribulations. It's part of it. And so I think the strengthening of the faith and our first thought, we're Christians first, all the time. Don brought that up as well. So I think that's a good message.
And we have a unique temptation, perhaps, in this country. That's one bell, right? Two? Oh, I got to quit. I got to talk. Stop talking. Anyway, Lord love you. What? Well, it's just that no other country that I know of has been founded like this country, where the guy said, hey, we need to pray about this. We need to get God involved. Let's mention God four times in our Declaration of Independence. Let's pattern the Constitution after biblical principles of human rights and the rights of the individual, where the state doesn't give rights, but the only reason we have a government is to protect the rights of the individuals. That's so unique here. We just don't have that in many places in the world. So that's why I think we should be grateful for it. Anyway, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's get ready for worship.